human beings love change, except when it happens to them, right? And so everyone says, yes, we want creativity, we want innovation, we want you to try new things, until you try new things. And then they're like, whoa, what are you doing?
Welcome to Talking Creativity, the Crania podcast from Dublin City University. I'm Ciarán Dunn.
I'm Giovinetti.
And I'm Tim Hannigan.
Welcome to Talking Creativity, the Crania podcast. Today, we have the pleasure to have a worldwide renowned scholar in the field of creativity and gifted education, the Julian Stanley Professor of Talent Development at Johns Hopkins University, Professor Jonathan Plucker. Jonathan's work focuses on creativity and exceptional performance and has appeared in several books and over 250 papers. He is a past president of the Society for the Psychology of Aesthetics, Creativity and the Arts, and current president of the National Association for Gifted Children in the United States. Dear Jonathan, it's such a pleasure to have you as a guest. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us and welcome to the podcast.
Ah, thank you, Joe. I really look forward to this conversation.
So before exploring the fascinating world of creativity and its implication for education, I would like to get to know you better. Your curriculum and experience are impressive. You're one of the world leading experts in the field of creativity and gifted education. Can you tell us how you first approached the field of creativity?
Well, ironically, I was in graduate school and we were studying intelligence and creativity. And I thought the study of human intelligence was the most interesting thing that I'd ever come across. And I thought that creativity was just the silliest waste of time. And all of my graduate student peers, Joe, felt the exact opposite. They all loved the creativity stuff and they found all of the intelligence stuff to be sort of controversial and dreary. And I think by the end of our time together, I convinced them that intelligence was more important than they thought, but they definitely convinced me that creativity was more important than I thought. And the more that I dug into it, I just really became fascinated with it. And I do think that it is one of the most important things that we can study as social scientists. But I also think for those of us who are working with students, it is, if not the most important outcome, one of the most important outcomes that we can strive for with our students. And pretty much how I've spent the last quarter century here studying creativity and working with students.
We'd like to ask one question to our guests, no matter what background they're coming from. And the question is, what single word do you associate with the concept of creativity?
Wow. Good question. The one that popped into my head first when you asked is Sternberg's 1988 edited volume, The Nature of Creativity. In part because it has a very personal connection for me, in that I was in my university bookstore. Again, I was a graduate student, and I was just starting to think that this creativity thing may be much more interesting than I thought it was, much more serious than I thought it was. And I was just browsing the bookshelves, and I came across this book, and I recognized Professor Sternberg's name. And I thought, wow, he's actually done a book on creativity. It's only a few years old. And I opened it up and I just devoured it. It was like the first academic book that I read word for word, cover to cover. And I was just really impressed by how much serious thinking had gone into what creativity was, why it was important, why it was a good outcome for students, and things like that, especially the Csikszentmihalyi chapter which I believe is the first time he really laid out his field domain person framework for creativity, which I still teach to my graduate students to this day. And so that entire book, I think, is just such a landmark, and especially that Csikszentmihalyi chapter.
Although studies on creativity started in the 50s and they progressed a huge deal, it looks like there are still some myths and stereotypes around this notion. Could you tell us something about how these myths and stereotypes can be damaging and hinder the development of creativity?
My colleagues and I, believe it or not, think that those myths and stereotypes are the biggest problem for people developing and using their own personal creativity. And we think it's a major barrier to creativity in teams, groups, et cetera, you know, collaborations. And I mean, I think the field has moved in this direction. When we first started saying this 15 years ago or so, we had a lot of people who thought that was a little crazy. But I think a lot of people now understand that creativity, sort of like long-term creative productivity, being, you know, creative over years, it is really largely about attitude. It's not completely about attitude, of course, but you have to have the motivation and the belief to be creative. And if there are any listeners who want more information about any of this stuff, they can just contact me directly and I'll be happy to send stuff along. But our model of creativity enhancement, it's basically a creativity education model, focuses a lot on sort of helping people examine these myths and stereotypes and then sort of working through them, helping them understand that, you know, for example, the major myth probably is that you're born creative or you're not. We have decades of research now that says that in many ways, that's almost a moot question. Whether you're born with it or you're not, we know that there are things that we can do to help you be more creative. So it doesn't, the question doesn't really matter. And so just helping people move through those myths and stereotypes, we believe, is just so important. I would point, some of the more recent work in this area would be Ron Baghetto's work at Arizona State, where he's doing a lot with students on creativity and failure. In that creative people, we tend to remember their creative successes, and we tend to ignore the fact that they almost always have lots of creative failure along the way. You know, if you're trying new things, that's a risky proposition, and more often than not, you're probably going to fail. But every once in a while, you're going to figure out how to make it work, and that's what we're really aiming for. So just bursting through this stereotype that, you know, creative people always succeed. Well, you know what? Turns out it's the exact opposite. So just helping people burst through those myths and stereotypes, we find to be a really good enhancement strategy, especially for college students.
From what you just said, and also from your scholarly articles, it really seems that you always trying to find a mid-ground in opposite theoretical frameworks within creativity. And I find it very useful in that it often helps to overcome a deadlock in the discussion. So often in creativity, you have opposite contrasting theoretical frameworks for that. And one question I would like to ask you, creativity, domain specific or domain general? And is it important at all?
You know, I used to think that that question was, I mean, a very interesting theoretical exercise, but primarily just a theoretical exercise. But as time has gone on, I actually think it's a pretty key question for when we for when we're helping students become more creative, especially college students, which is where I focused a lot of my work. And to give you an example, we know that one of the most difficult things in learning for students is transfer, right? You can learn a skill, but then transferring it and sort of generalizing that skill to other even similar contexts is very, very difficult for humans. So my concern is that if we teach creativity only within specific domains, the research strongly suggests that it's going to be really hard for students to then take what they've learned about creativity, about their own creativity, about working in teams on creativity, on creative tasks, excuse me. They're going to have a really hard time transferring that to other situations. Our basic approach tries to build on all of the work on cognitive transfer of learning, and also, you know, just sociocultural theory in general, and the fact that creativity certainly has both domain general and domain specific characteristics. So we start by helping students just explore creativity in general. Try to blast through those myths and stereotypes. Lots of problem-based learning, very, very diverse types of problems. Then they can focus more on creativity within their disciplines, but then bring it all back at the very end and sort of have, I don't know what you'd call it in Ireland, but here we call it a capstone experience, where they come back for like a final seminar where they do look very carefully at all of the domain general pieces and all those domain specific pieces so that they can start to make those generalizations. We think that is a fairly good approach. And like you said, it's a very moderate middle ground approach. But I mean, when we're trying to help students, I think that's the approach that works best with creativity.
How important is the environment for creativity? On the path to creativity, failure is a possibility. And it seems that often enough, especially in higher education, there is not really room for failure. People want to, and it's fair enough, students want to achieve a good grade, a good mark. So how important is to actually create an environment that can be fruitful for creativity?
Good question. It's an important question. I'm going to kind of answer it in a strange way. It's both not important at all and very, very important. Okay. So I do think that we overemphasize having the right conditions to be creative. I think part of creativity in several intelligence theories, like we talked about Dr. Sternberg's theories before. They really emphasize the ability to adapt to your environment or to change your environment to adapt to you. I just think that's a very important creative trait in general. In life, we don't get to pick our conditions often, and yet we still have to solve problems. We still have to be creative in order to be successful. So I think we've probably emphasized the environment too much in that regard. And I mean, I'm not saying it's not important. It is. Is it as important as some people make it out to be? Probably not. I think being able to adapt to multiple environments is really the key for long-term creative productivity. Now, at the same time, if I were a low-income student who didn't have a lot of people around me modeling creativity, who didn't have special classes after school, who didn't necessarily have teachers focused on creative problem solving. To that child, the environment is incredibly important, and it's probably not very helpful. So the answer, I think, to your question is yes and no. Yes, it's very, very important. There's clearly sort of a minimum set of environmental conditions that people need to have. I sound a little bit like Maslow and Rogers now talking about needs, but that's actually part of it, I think. Once you hit that minimum threshold, though, I'm not sure it does or it should matter all that much, if that makes sense.
It does, absolutely. But I will press on the same topic in a way, in that we can see how creativity is increasingly identifies a key educational outcome in many countries now. Yet, there are still difficulties implementing educational tools to foster it. What would you recommend to those who are committed to teaching for creativity?
Well, I think the big thing that I run into, Joe, when I talk to colleagues, whether it's primary students, secondary students, undergraduates, graduate students, is there's this belief that in order for one to promote creativity in their teaching, they have to do this big overhaul of the entire curriculum. They have to teach very, very differently. And I just don't think the research supports that. I think the research says that there are, for most teachers, they're probably doing more than they realize, or they're very, very close to it. For example, I had an engineering professor contact me once, and he said, I'd never met him before. And he said, look, I'm going to retire in 3 years. So I finally feel like I have the freedom to change everything I do so I can promote creativity more. And I let him talk and explain what he does. And my first comment to him was, who told you you have to overhaul everything? The fact that he's even having that conversation with me is probably a pretty good indicator that he's already doing some small things. So we just need to build up off of those. I'm a very big believer in the fact that long-term creative problem solvers are very good about soliciting and using feedback. Every once in a while, instead of having students just turn a project in to you as the teacher, have them present it to the entire class, and then work with the students on how you can persuade people that your work is important, that it's creative, that it's innovative. And at the same time, work with the other students so that they can learn how to give good constructive criticism and not just criticism. Those are really important creativity skills. That's not hard to do. You don't have to do it constantly either, just every once in a while, and you can scaffold it throughout the year. If you have students working on a certain task, just being open to the fact that there may be multiple correct answers, there may be there may be multiple strategies that students can use, in order to solve a certain problem, answer a certain question. In our experience, it's those small things that matter. And then just to give positive feedback when you do see students taking some creative risks, again, whether it works or not, and, you know, being able to point out and say, hey, I saw your project and it didn't quite work, but, you know, you convinced me that you were trying something a little different and you took a risk and I really liked that. Do you want to try again? And I think things like that are really important. I don't think that's terribly insightful, because I think that that's how the real world often works. You don't like create something and turn it into someone and then walk away, right? You persuade people that the work that you've done is really good. If they don't like it or they'd like to see some things fixed, they give you feedback, and then you incorporate that feedback. Or, you know, again, maybe it doesn't work at all. Maybe you've completely failed, but you've learned from that and you build on top of it and you try again. I don't think there's any reason why, especially at the college level, at the university level, why we can't model lots of those behaviors.
So a lot comes down to the relationship between students, among students, and between students and professors as well, in terms of the feedback they receive and the way this feedback are provided as well. It sounded like you have incorporated the idea of failure as actually part of learning and is valued in itself because it's leading to something new, something else. My question then is, how does creativity fit in an educational system that is quite standardized?
Why don't I give you a personal example? One of the things, and I know why it's happening in the States, but it still worries me, is that we are becoming increasingly standardized within higher education. So like things that would have never done even a decade ago, like having a standard syllabus template, like that's just the way that things work now. And so things have become much more standardized. I have serious concerns about what that does to our ability to foster students' creativity, especially professional level creativity. But one thing that I do is, and this drives my some of my colleagues crazy, is I don't give individual grades for like projects and papers, tests. Tests I sometimes do, but what I do instead is I provide written feedback on absolutely everything each student does throughout the entire year. And I just have sort of a running transcript. And sometimes in those notes, I tell them that I'd like them to redo the entire project, or I just say, wow, I don't think that this worked for you. You should really try again. We meet in the middle of each semester, one-on-one, to go over my notes, to go over their various projects and papers. And we talk about what they think their grade is. And then we agree on what they need to do the second half of that course. And then we keep that process up and we get to the very end. And then we meet during the very last week of classes and we have an in-depth discussion about what their grade should be and why they think their grade should be, whatever they think it should be. I'd say 95% of the time we readily agree on what that grade should be. I enter that grade and we're fine. I found some interesting things. I started doing this probably about 15 years ago, give or take, Joe. I almost never get any student who doesn't like their grade at the end. When I was using a much more rigid sort of traditional grading system, I got complaints a lot. I think the student creativity is much, much, much higher. So there's less miscommunication. I think it's just a better way to think about grading. It's a very criterion referenced assessment approach. Because I have that grade at the very end of the course, the university is none the wiser, and it looks like I'm fitting into their fairly standardized system. But I do have to say, I think it's a battle. I think that university leaders, administrators, need to be sensitive that, you know, standardization helps with quality control to a point. But you want there to always be exceptions. You want it to be flexible rules so that someone who really has thought out carefully how doing it differently would be very positive for students is allowed to prove that. I'm concerned that at lots of universities now, things are becoming so standardized that that's getting harder and harder to do. But I mean, it's possible. It's definitely possible.
What would you say to a colleague that is really, really committed to implement teaching for creativity, and yet they actually feel overwhelmed by the constraints and demands coming from this necessity for testing and accountability?
Well, the first thing I would say is, find a friend, find a colleague who is very sympathetic to what you're trying to do. Because having a partner when you're sort of charging this windmill, so to speak, is really important. I had that when I first started doing these things in the college classroom, especially. And it was just nice to be able to sit down with a colleague at the end of a day after I taught and say, wow, it just didn't go well today. Or, you know, my department chair is really pressuring me to produce this sort of stuff. What do I do? So definitely find a friend who's very sympathetic to these things. And then, you know, I mean, I think in some ways, creativity is always a fairly subversive construct, right? Like you're doing things that are different. And different things, they always bother people. The way that I tend to think about it, Joe, is that human beings love change, except when it happens to them, right? And so everyone says, yes, we want creativity, we want innovation, we want you to try new things, until you try new things. And then they're like, whoa, what are you doing? So I think you just have to be persistent. At the same time, I personally found that having good theoretical conceptual reasons for what you're doing really makes a huge difference. One, it just increases your chances of success. Two, I think it definitely helps if someone calls you in and says, hey, I hear you're trying this new thing. That sounds weird to me. Can you explain it? To say, oh yeah, here's why I'm doing it. Here's why it should work. Here's how I'm gonna collect evidence to see if it does work. I think most uni systems react well to that basic type of approach, but I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it's easy. I mean, I have colleagues who still, when they find out that I don't give individual grades on every single assignment, are just horrified. And I mean horrified, like their eyes get wide, their jaw drops. They're like, wait, you know, you don't use, you know, a detailed assignment rubrics and et cetera. And I say, oh yeah, I never ever use them and I never will. They're just stunned and they are convinced it's never going to work. But I have the evidence that it does. So it, I just think being smart about it, like you would about almost anything else. In some ways, I've never thought of it this way before until just now. You have to be very creative about teaching for creativity. That's really what this is about. And any of the techniques that I'm mentioning are things that we share with students on how to improve their own personal creativity. So I don't think it's rocket science, but I'm not saying it's easy either, because you have to be really persistent.
How important do you think is the student's mindset so to approach a creative way of learning as well, because is the counterpart of teaching for creativity is also about learning for creativity. Did you find students ready to experiment, because is a risk for them as well?
That's a really good question. I guess I would answer it in two ways. I would say, I think over time I have found that more and more students are coming to the university level and they're hungering for more creativity fostering approaches to teaching and learning. So I think that has definitely changed. I think at the same time, we need to keep in mind that a student, let's say, take your typical graduate student. They've made it to graduate school. They are almost certainly a good student, right? To get to that level. Good students know how to play the game. They know how to be told exactly what the expectations are. They meet those expectations. They read the grading rubrics that you pass out, and they know exactly what the recipe is to get a good grade. Now, then someone like me comes along and says, there is no recipe in life. I want you to be thinking differently about things, and the degree to which you're successful in doing that, that to me is adult professional level success. For many of them, that's a very difficult transition, in part because we're asking them to think differently about how they sort of think about people in general, which is very ingrained by the time they've gotten to us, you know, even as first year undergraduates, you know, young adults. And that's why whenever I'm teaching students like this, the first few assignments are fairly cookie cutter things. Do this, think about this, tell me about this. But the goal is over the course of that semester to slowly take a lot of those constraints, a lot of those criteria away, so that by the time we get to the end of the course, I have them thinking more like a professional. Essentially, you know, using rules and using guidelines when they have to, but when they don't have to, being able to think on their own, being able to think when they have a blank page in front of them without someone saying, this is exactly what you need to do to succeed. I'm not going to lie. That's a very difficult transition for lots of students. I think often more successful students struggle with it even more because they're so used to knowing what the formula is to get that, to get really good marks. But I've never had a student in doing this again for nearly a quarter century now who didn't by the end become much more comfortable with not being given sort of with the standard success formula. And I think that's, again, because humans do crave the ability to be creative. We just have to kind of teach them how, because I think they've largely lost that by the time they get to us at the university and college level.
What is the relationship between creativity and giftedness?
To me, giftedness is high levels of performance, or just even potential in any area of sort of human endeavor. I'm not really sure how creativity interacts with that. We do know that people who tend to exhibit those high levels of student performance tend to be creative or tend to have lots of creative potential. I think that that's really important. Colloquially, I often describe creativity to people as taking old stuff, combining it with other stuff to create new stuff. And the more stuff you know, the more information you've learned, the more concepts that you have in your brain, I think the easier it is to be creative. Again, that's very, very colloquial, but I think it's a pretty good way to think about it. We all know people who are just very good at taking a different perspective, thinking of a connection that no one else is seeing, finding a solution to a problem no one else could find. And maybe people didn't even see the problem, until they pointed it out. Are all those people gifted? Are they creatively gifted? I don't know. I think that's a pretty complicated question.
You have characterized creativity as subversive. That poses the question of the relationship between creativity and ethics. Do you think there should be a link between creativity and ethics?
Yeah, I absolutely think there should be. I think a problem that we often have is that we don't emphasize this. And let me give you a very practical example. I've been concerned about this for a long time. And I was listening to public radio over here. This is about, I don't know, a year or two ago, Joe. And they were doing a story on deep fakes with video. right? So for people who don't know what that is that computing power and artificial intelligence have advanced to the point that we can make videos of things that look extremely real that are not, right? And so this obviously has massive ethical implications. You could smear opponents by placing them in videos doing questionable things where, you know, they weren't anywhere near where it happened. So it has lots of ethical implications. But I was really marked by the fact that, so they started out the story talking to the scientists who are working on this, and they're super enthusiastic. And they also talked about lots of the positive benefits. Great, granted. But then they talked to, you know, people who were like, gosh, I'm really worried about this. It's really hard to tell if these are faked or not. As this technology gets better, it may be impossible to tell. So what do you do if people use this for bad reasons? And then they ended the story by going back to the scientists and saying, you know, how do you feel about all of the, you know, all of the potential for this technology to be misused? And the scientists, it was really telling, the scientists were speechless. They were like, what do you mean? Like, no one would use this for bad reasons. And like, this was such a transparent case of where a huge creative advance had potentially disastrous negative ethical implications, moral and ethical implications. And the creators clearly never had thought about it. And they were just dumbfounded by these questions. That really impacted me. And there are different schools of thought on this. I have some colleagues who say creativity is neither good or bad. It's how people use it. So we shouldn't be worrying about ethics. I have others who say the same thing, but then use the same logic to say, so we should be, you know, worried about ethics, especially at a time where where our technological grasp is really starting to exceed our understanding of what this, you know, of what these amazing creative advances means. I think we do have to talk to students about ethical decision making. And I was listening to one inventor, and he was talking about a new technology they had come up with that, the topic was making bathroom facilities that didn't use water or that used very little water. Especially within countries that have very little water, wasting most of it to flush waste away within bathrooms is a huge environmental problem. And so they very quickly invented urinals, toilets, et cetera, that didn't need any water whatsoever. I mean, this is a massive breakthrough. And I was in the audience of this talk, and then someone raised their hand and said, well, how long have you been working on this? And they said, oh, we actually figured this out about 5 or 6 years ago. And so the person said, well, if you did it 5 or 6 years ago, why on earth haven't you put these all over the planet? It would change humanity. And they said, well, we will tell you exactly why. And it's that the only way we figured out to make this is so amazingly toxic, it would absolutely defeat any benefit we got from saving all of this water. And that to me was a fairly enlightened sort of pro-ethics perspective on creativity, that you do need to consider the sort of unexpected costs. I think we need to do it. Now, that said, I'm constantly looking for good strategies to help inject ethical considerations into the teaching of creativity. And other than just talking to students about it, I'm not finding really good strategies for that. So if anyone listening has good strategies for that, I would love for them to share it. Because that's just something that I think we really need to get a better handle on. And in this day and age, if you can't look around and see creativity that has huge ethical implications, things like social media, these are things that maybe we should be doing a better job anticipating.
Jonathan, thank you. And we are now approaching the end of our conversation. But before I thank you again for your time, I have one more question that we ask every guest that come over to the podcast. And it's a fun question for me. And it is, if you had a magic wand, what would you change to increase creative outcomes?
Well, it would probably be among the things that I've talked about. If I could get every college level instructor, teacher, professor, just to have one or two really open-ended projects, assignments, activities within their class, I think that would make a huge, huge, huge difference. But in order to do that, there'd need to be extra support, and leaders would have to sort of relax a little bit about some of the standardized requirements. But I think that is really, really important. I think every major in every higher education institution in the world should have an annual creativity, innovation, entrepreneurship prize to a student who's done a project that is just pushes the envelope, that just makes us think differently about something, that solves an old problem in a new way, a project that identifies a new problem that people hadn't thought about. I think that alone helps start to change the culture, and really integrates creativity into all that we do at the university level, which I think is really important, because I really do think that creativity is infused in everything we do as human beings outside of the university. So I think that just makes a lot of sense.
Thank you so much for being with us today. We hope to hear from you again. And meanwhile, if you have any final remarks you want to make, this is your chance.
I just want to start out by thanking you and DCU Credney for inviting me to do this. That means a lot to me. I've been watching what DCU does in this area closely, and I'm very excited to see where you all take this. Of course, if there's anything that I've talked about, or if I can help anyone in any way as they think about teaching creativity, or I should say, teaching for creativity, for innovation, for entrepreneurship at the college level, at the university level, please contact me. I am always happy to, jump on Zoom or email, whatever. And I'm happy to help.
Thank you so much. Another episode of Talking Creativity, the Creania podcast.
In this series, we talk to academic experts on creativity, creative practitioners, people from the creative industries and the arts, and those working across disciplines and at the boundaries between scholarship and practice.
The aim of these conversations is to dig into creativity, to figure out what it means, and above all, to explore ways to encourage it in any field or discipline.
The Cranier Project is based at Dublin City University and is funded by the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education.